thank you very much for coming to this event tonight. I am really, really pleased to see all of you here, because what we represent here is a whole bunch of different parts of the community. And really what this book represents is life, not just in academia, but in all of our communities. So it's really great to see this great spread of participants here. My name is Diana Rivera. I hope I've made a connection with each and every one of you tonight. I am the Chicano Studies librarian. I head up the Cesar Chavez Collection, and I work in special collections. One of the things that I was working on, I've been given the great privilege of developing the Chicano Latino Artist Book Collection, which is a small part of an overall artist collection that we have here at the libraries. Tonight, I want to introduce Dr. Sheila Contreras, who's our co-collaborator, our co-sponsor for the event tonight, who heads up the Chicano Latino Studies Outreach Program.
Thanks. Well, we're really so happy to have a place for Chicano Latino Studies at an event like this. Chicano Latino Studies here at Michigan State, we really are the center of
the production of knowledge by and about, I don't think I need this to it. I've been cursed with a big voice. The center of the protection of knowledge by and about Latinos here at Michigan State. And as a sort of center of knowledge production, we have deep links to and investment in libraries. I think that, you know, without libraries, I mean, I find libraries to be really exciting places. And I'm always trying to get students to come to the library, you know, to see what a different experience it is than just you know, downloading everything from their solitary terminal, wherever they are. I think also that libraries are often misperceived as places of, you know, they can be this, of course, as all institutions can be, of deeply entrenched traditions and values and perhaps even limited ways of perceiving knowledge and textual value. But I think what Felicia Rice's work will show us is that, remind us even, is that radical cutting-edge work has always happened in libraries. It has always happened in libraries. And this can help call our attention to that, to the library as a place of profound conceptual work, and also remind us of the transformative potential of the bibliographic space. And so Chicano Latino Studies, we're really proud to be associated with this. Diana Rivera, you know, it was all her idea, her organizing. We're really lucky that Ms. Rice was able to come here. And so thank you all for being here.
And because this is an artist book, many of us, actually I'm relatively new to the artist book tradition and information for, I think 2 years is only what I've known it to exist or to what it was. But we have Patrick Olson, who's the rare books librarian at Special Collections here in Michigan, or at Michigan State, and he's going to give us a little background on artist book and the artist book tradition.
Thank you, Diana. And let me go ahead and try. I'm going to hook up the lapel mic real quick.
Now, oh wait, there we go. This is all being recorded for posterity.
That wasn't you.
That wasn't me?
No.
Okay, good. I was very concerned.
He just rolled down a hill and no. It wasn't you.
All right, now that that's behind us, just a little bit about the work you're seeing tonight. Doc, Undoc, Documentado, Undocumented, Ars Shamanica, Performatica, is a limited edition artist book, the outcome of a 7-year collaboration. This edition of 65 books features Guillermo Gomez Pena's performance texts and Felicia Rice's relief prints and typography, accompanied by Jennifer Gonzalez's critical commentary. Of these, a deluxe edition of 15 is housed in a high-tech aluminum case containing a video by Gustavo Vazquez, an altar, and a cabinet of curiosities. Opening the case triggers light and Zachary Watkins' interactive sound art. This series of short monologues traces Rice's metamorphosis from book artist, printer, to artist, performer. The performance begins with the publication of Doc Undoc this fall and wends its way through a series of experiences and epiphanies that reach back to her early years. Doc Undoc's subtitle, Documentado Undocumented, points to a painful dichotomy. Documentado in Spanish implies having access to cultural traditions and rituals that flourish in Mexico, whereas the term undocumented in the United States implies a lack of citizenship, power, rights, and knowledge. The second subtitle, Ars Shamanica Performatica, speaks of the very personal, transformative experience offered by the book and case, an invitation to choose an object, find a poetic way of using it, reimagine yourself, tell a new story. In some way, every immigrant must reinvent his or herself, just as every artist must cross into the unknown and return to tell the tale. So that's a bit about what you're seeing tonight and the work of art behind you. And I'm going to give everyone just a very, very brief introduction to artist books for those who may not be familiar with it. Artist books, first of all, are not to be confused with the art book, which is that square thing that's stuffed with, you know, reproductions of Impressionist paintings that sits on the end table beside your sofa. That is an art book. Tonight we're looking at artist books. And very broadly speaking, an artist book is a work of art that manifests itself in the form of a book. And I mean very broadly speaking. When did this tradition sort of take root? You'll find people who will point to medieval manuscripts as artist books. You know, the combination of medieval painting and the book. Many people will cite William Blake's Songs of Innocence from 1789 as, you know, the original artist book, and that, you know, he designed this the entire book, text, and illustration himself as one cohesive unit. More than anything, I think a lot of scholars and book artists point to the French Livre d'Artiste movement in the early 20th century as the sort of the origins of the modern artist book. The Livre d'Artiste is a tradition whereby modern masters team up with printers and publishers to produce deluxe editions of either very very classical texts or modern texts. Some common, well, I should say popular modern American examples are the edition of Picasso that Henri Matisse illustrated, the edition of Ulysses that Matisse illustrated, and the Salvador Dali's Alice in Wonderland, those kinds of books that then kind of morphed into a very broad evolution of the artist book to the point where you get to the 1970s and the art is really sort of coming into its own and finally getting accepted as in the critical circles. So artist books, when we talk about them, this is modern work that challenges and expands the concept of the traditional book. So it's challenging its design, its form, its material, its content. You'll see board games, hinged blocks, being touted as artist books, as a kind of book, and that they do use the allied crafts of bookmaking, such as printing methods, bookbinding methods, papermaking methods, calligraphy. And if you sort of struggle to accept a particular piece of a book, or a particular piece as a book, that's okay. I would just remind you that the written conveyance of human thought and expression is not married to the codex, which is what we the typical book you buy at the bookstore now. It's a bunch of pages stacked between two covers. That form has been in use for about 1,800 years. Clay tablets were in use before the codex for over 2,000 years. Egyptian papyrus scrolls were in common use for 3,000 years. So don't think of the traditional codex as the only way to convey thought and expression in words. If you'd like to explore the artist books a bit more, please do come down to Special Collections. We have a wonderful selection of artist books, many of them the work of individuals, a lot of them collaborations between artists, such as Felicia Rice's product tonight. We have a significant collection of Cuban books from a collective in Matanzas known as Ediciones Vigia. We also have works by other Chicano and Latino book artists, A sample of work by Freya Diamond, Jenna Rodriguez, Matt Cohen, and Cher Zabaskowitz is currently on display in the first floor's Cesar A. Chavez collection and the center display case at the base of the stairwell. So why do we collect these and why are these important? Like sculpture or music or painting, the artist book is a means of human expression. Any expressive movement, especially one as widely practiced as the book arts, is worth preserving. And we owe it to our community and to posterity to provide access to this work, to capture the evolution of this movement, and for libraries in particular, to document the broadening spectrum of the handmade book as it's pitted against a growing digital landscape. This is not an American genre. This is an international movement, and Chicanos and Latinos are a growing presence in it. The MSU Libraries is proud to be providing a space for these voices and these works to offer users broad international exposure to this field for research, for teaching, and just as importantly, for inspiration. Now, the thing about artist books that I read really fascinates me and that I find wonderful is that they're often just at home in traditional museums as they are in a library. Rice's work, for example, can be found not only here and within the hallowed walls of the Bodleian Library at Oxford, it can also be found at the Whitney Museum of American Art. And it is this dual nature that has brought us together tonight. It's this dual nature that has the capacity to bring together artists and bookmakers, librarians and museum curators, readers and art lovers. It's what brings performance art into the library. And this is what it means to challenge the concept of the book. So please, enjoy the book, enjoy the performance, and I hope you'll come see us in Special Collections sometime soon. So I'll turn it over to Felicia.
Oh, thank you. Well, tonight, Diana Rivera, our Chicano Latino Studies librarian, will be my collaborator for the first time, and she will be driving the visuals that accompany my presentation. Thank you so much, Diana, for undertaking this leap into spontaneity. And with that, let's get started. So, would you like to know more about what you have been looking at? The artist's book, Doc Undoc, Documentado Undocumented, Ars Shamanica Performatica? The first subtitle, Documentado Undocumented, is also the title of the video element of this artist's book. The video is made up of a series of performance pieces in homage to colleagues and friends, as well as ritual actions for the camera, such as one-on-one duels or performances between the performer and the videographer, which ask, who is the author? What is the space in between? Documentado undocumented refers to a painful dichotomy, as we just heard. Documentado in Spanish implies being informed, having access to cultural forms and traditions, histories and rituals that flourish in Mexico. Whereas the term undocumented in the United States implies a host of negative stereotypes, including a lack of citizenship, rights, knowledge, and power. Gomez Peña's scripts are gathered from his performances and draw on his immigrant experiences and personal observations of the political and sociocultural landscape, the geographic, social, and psychological boundaries between the United States and Mexico. On stage, he brings the words to life, and we pass into another world of shamanic proportions, shifting how we perceive ourselves, crossing borders. The book interprets and performs the text in the absence of the performance artist. It evokes the striking and conflicted nature of the writer-performer and the text. The book is grounded in border issues and immigration policy and visually adheres to Chicano iconography, skulls, mariachi, lowrider cars, chihuahuas, conflated with a new, more personal iconography, contorted animals, awkward figures, abstractions. The edges of the prints form margins that the images may cross into. They fold down the center of each spread is the border we each must cross as we bring the known to the unknown and back again. As a printmaker, I ask, what color is it this morning? What relationships exist between images? What visual dynamic? And as a book artist, how can this print be consistent with, yet different from the last? Here's some white ink, add some transparency for viscosity, then red, blue, getting a lavender here, and the question, how will this reveal what is below and suggest what color or image comes next? Is this spread sincere and caring, or leering and challenging the viewer to come up close? I'm looking for a love-hate relationship. It hurts a bit, but can be hilarious while it's biting your neck. It's biting my neck, and it hurts right now as I apply color to the press, place the printing plates in position, and pull the first proof. It's a performance moment for this participant observer, a critical audience of one. Satisfied for now, I step off into the press run, anxiously exercising the principles of my craft, checking the impression, finding the best inking, maintaining it, making sure the plates don't move any more than I'm willing to accept, keeping the sheet clean. A rhythm takes hold, something is wrong. I blinked and lost the original color. Too much ink, not enough red. Then back on track, though certainly not the exact match to the first choice, and the sheets are slowly coming off the press, each one fed by hand, each one unique. After 40 years of this, I'm elated by the beauty of the lavender texture coupled with the reds and blues of my drawings, evoking the voice of the performer. Deanna, could you move the next image into place? Okay. Labor. The trip mechanism is broken. A spring has snapped. In replacing the spring, a pin is driven hard against the master cylinder and prevents the cylinder from turning. We try to pull the pin back out, but there's no budging it. Now the press is fully broken, and my tight production schedule is out the window. I call for help, and Alan arrives the next day, toolbox and diagrams in hand. Slowly, we map the problem to the plans and find the only solution. The cylinder must be completely disassembled. Day one. This is complicated. A false move may disable the press permanently. We roll the carriage to the end of the press bed and loosen the nuts that hold the carriage together. We lift the carriage from the press and lower it to the floor. It is almost more than Alan can handle, even with my help. The right punch and heavy hammer drive the pin through the wall of the cylinder and out completely. We eat lunch, then reverse the process. The back-breaking labor of lifting the carriage back up onto the bed of the press and aligning the gears. But the trip mechanism is still broken. That night, poring over the diagram, Alan finds the necessary relationships between the pins, the springs, and the parts. Day two. After several false starts, slowly we reconstruct the mechanism. My fingers are there to hold the small bits in place while Alan assembles the larger parts. Pieces snap off and fly across the room and drop to the floor, but we work slow and steady. Finally, Alan tightens down the nuts on the far side of the press, and I tighten those on the operator's side. We ink up the press and run a test sheet over the cylinder and down the press bed. Praise be, the sheet prints and the gripper releases the sheet as they should. By the end of the afternoon, we have adjusted the roller bearers and the cylinder bearers, cleaned and lubricated all moving parts. Press repaired, a thing of beauty. What is beauty? Craft can show you. A slow birthing until at last the work measures up and transcends its own standard of excellence. Once we can perceive the effort, the tension between the materials and the making, the final piece fully resolves and is perfect. Is art beauty? That is not the question for art. The question is, what can art do? Then I'm back to making art on my beautiful press, making with dirty hands, aching back, feet, and hip, heavy metal, fine paper, exquisite inks, uneven line, exhausted and anxious and elated. Art can unnerve and move, entertain and explain, question and transform, reinforce our beliefs and extend them into new territory. Art can be labor, just as labor can be art. Deanna? I think one of the reasons the colors aren't as bright as we'd like is because the lights are on in the back of the room over the food. Does anyone know how to turn those off? If not, not. But, okay. Exposure. Did you grow up with artists? It makes a difference. My father's studio was filled with burlap sacks of mosaic tiles, tile clippers, paste, paper, paints, colored pencils, work surfaces, a tool bench with jars of screws and nuts and nails, a potter's wheel and kiln, a cleanup sink big enough to bathe in, and a wood stove made from a 50-gallon drum. Everything had a name and an area where it lived. While some tools collected dust, others were in use daily. People came to work, to learn, to talk. My father spent most days there before he left to teach evening classes in painting and drawing at the nearby community college. This room, and it seemed enormous, had a purpose. Those who entered joined in that purpose, that of the labor of making things with one's hands. Gluing colored mosaics to paper in intricate designs, building sculptures and murals, and later making drawing after drawing to form animated films with mysterious meanings and cacophonous soundtracks. I knew this was serious work and did my best to squirm my way in. I was allowed to visit, supervised, and then, at last, finally, unsupervised, to work at the drawing table on my map of Europe in the seventh grade. I was not allowed unsupervised until I was 12 years old. It was an initiation. But I also snuck my way in to look at the anatomy books, to show my friends the weird and scary things there. Far more attractive than anatomy were the books of black and white prints by the Mexican artist Posada. Who knew what was real or surreal? Images of women birthing twin dragons, skeletons dancing with enormous hats on their skull heads, laughing, leering old men, murders in progress, hangings, religious processions. My parents were art students in New York City in the early 40s and were influenced by the Mexican artists working in this country and by the marriage of art and politics. Their friends were friends of Frida Kahlo's and had apprenticed to Diego Rivera. Peripatetic after the war, my parents set out in an old station wagon from Vermont with their two tiny daughters to work with the muralist David Alfaro Siqueiros in San Miguel de Allende. His family lore that the two girls nearly died and that my father raced to Mexico City and procured a new exotic medicine that saved their lives and allowed the family to retreat to the Western United States. Early exposure to the Mexican artists and their American apprentices eventually led me to collaborate with Latino writers and artists of my own generation. Early exposure to the work of Mexican printmaker Jose Guadalupe Posada led me to the work of Artemio Rodriguez, a contemporary printmaker whose work is inspired by that of Posada, and to John J. Leaños, and to their collaborative El Muerto Rider, an image of which appears in the book. Guillermo Gomez Peña's performance script, Tired of Walking North, is paired here with an art car tilted up and planted in the soil of the desert, like those of Ant Farm's Cadillac Ranch, a public installation in Texas dating from 1974. This page spread speaks to the treacherous walk through the desert toward opportunity beckoning in the north. Would this be the car you'd hope to find, or the illusion thereof, that would inspire one more step toward marvelous possibilities or deep disappointment? And the text here reads, "We are definitely tired. Tired of working all day for very little money, of feeling lonely and disconnected from our heart, our genitals, and neighbors, from our country and our so-called political representatives, their foreign policy, their mythical high security, their endless wars against difference. We are tired of being afraid of mythical terrorists and illegal aliens, afraid of our own inner demons. We are all tired. Praise the Lord and all her names and shapes." And that's the text of Guillermo Gomez Peña that makes up the written word in this book. And then, in the middle of the night, I lost my way. With my husband asleep in our room next door and my 11-year-old in his room downstairs, I am up, driven out of sleep by work, mind on fire, planning my own work, its future, the next enormous project by my students. Then, out of nowhere, my feverish ambition falls away in the complete collapse of my nervous system. I am falling, spinning, disoriented, shaking uncontrollably, terrified. I call my mother, barely able to hold the phone. She says, "Ask your husband for help. He will help you." Once more, she is right. He massages me and speaks softly, and finally I get up from the floor and with the first light of day walk the demanding hill of our street until I am physically exhausted. Eventually, the only thing that settles me, besides medication, is movement, walking, yoga, meditation, and deep sleep. My mind continues to race and my body shake with anxiety for months. My chest feels like it will never unlock around the vibrating rock that is lodged where my heart should be. I can't be alone, yet I have nothing to offer those around me. Even my son's needs and my husband's fears can't reach me. I am frightened and unable to function. They call this a nervous breakdown. But my therapist says, think of it as a nervous breakthrough. Your body, your mind, your spirit are telling you to slow down. You are depleted and need to rest. If it weren't for the pills, I would be one of the many women lying quietly in a darkened room, quaking day after day. As it is, I sit on the couch in the evening as the sun sets and watch the light change. First, the tree limbs form silhouettes against a deepening blue that illuminates each detail of the edge. Then the growing gold of the interior lights of the room begin to reflect in the window. And at that moment, the two, inside and outside merge into one. Later, I reach for that layering in my prints, and I call these stages of the work ghosts and reflections. If you print a solid, add an image in white, then lay down a related color, the ghost of the image emerges. The following drawings or textures retain the ghost and suggest the reflection of the interior as well as the strong limbs outside. Together, the complexity of the layers appear as one, something to reflect upon. Diana, next image. Are you having fun yet? I am. And for a very specific reason. I'm scared. I'm scared of you. Scared of revealing too much of myself and of learning I don't like what I see. Scared of talking without communicating. I'm scared and trembling. But risk is linked to fun. We want and need to have fun to punctuate our daily lives. I'm taking a risk here. I don't know you. But the exhilaration of reaching out to you is worth the risk of failure. In the summer of 2011, I take a La Pocha Nostra work performance art workshop with my collaborator, Guillermo Gomez Peña, and his troupe. My intention is to work more closely with Guillermo in order to further my work with the book as performance art. My research into the book object performing the text. Very quickly, I realize I am also looking into the book artist as performance artist. So for 2 weeks, I live with 26 others from around the world in a basement performance space in downtown San Francisco. We eat, sleep, bare ourselves and our bodies, and work together using techniques and exercises that take us into internal spaces that can be quite dark and scary, but fun. The challenge is to reveal those dark, hidden places and experience them with others. Let me set the stage. First, clothe yourself in any combination of costumes and props and reach for shared meaning with another. Slowly disrobe and extend your bodies out along the floor, rolling and wrapping yourselves in a cocoon of ropes. Open your eyes, check in. What movement would add to the mix of movement and play? Clinging to the wall like an insect? If only we could. Move in slow motion in a feather boa as a figure streaks across the room behind you, carrying a replica of a gun. Now focus on the writhing mound in the center of the performance space. Bodies slither in the periphery. Join in. Stretch. My mother had died the year before at the age of 92. I was old. At a natural death at home. With the encouragement of the troupe, I relive her death through a spoken word performance before an audience. White sheer nightgown, spaghetti straps slipping from my shoulders. Wide red clown mouth smeared across my face. I loll on a chair, slowly breathing, whispering the story of her last days, and twisting repeatedly to the left. Drugged and delirious, over and over, she lifts her head and upper body and heaves herself to the left. The repeated gesture is common to the dying. She is going, but where? Going to die? Going to meet her maker? Going home? Going to say goodbye? Going to see her loved ones long gone themselves? My niece climbs up on the bed and holds her between her legs. It looks like the act of birth, but does not calm her. We move her limp body to a wheelchair and slowly push her around the house until she nearly slides from the chair. She is leaving us. She is going. And finally, after one last breath and 11 days, she went. Diana, next image, please. Message. I'd like to take a look at this again. The medium is the massage. Better known as the medium is the message, was bathroom readings for months when I was a kid. The massage was the publisher's typo, but author Marshall McLuhan embraced the mistake. And either way, my folks got the message and passed it on to me. Media is a mighty powerful tool, busily manipulating our perception and experience, a mighty force in a changing world. I entered the age of technology, the information age, at a tender age, and ever since then, everything has only reinforced that early exposure. The books I make are informed by both digital and analog processes. In making them, I pass back and forth between the digital and the tangible, between setting type letter by letter on the screen and setting type letter by letter from a 19th century type case. I print my negatives from a computer to a laser printer, make photopolymer relief plates, and print images from these surfaces on a 50-year-old letterpress. I build a textured surface of dust from the U.S.-Mexico border, varnish it, run inky rollers over that landscape, and print directly from the earth to the paper. I take rubbings from our linoleum floors, our driveway, the cement of the shop floor, the backs of wooden letters, then scan and manipulate them on my computer desktop, make plates, and print them on a Vandercook proof press. I make 100 sketches, choose 30, scan and manipulate them on screen, make plates, cut the plates up, and collage together images of twisted bodies, a tiger drooling, a melange of fonts, a wild man tearing his hair, loving skeletons or calaveras in embrace. My work has moved beyond the traditional structured page of marching letter forms carefully, avoiding one another, to a wild and crazy intimate dance performed by friends who know each other very well. We are living in a visual world and a less and less literate one. McLuhan pointed it out 50 years ago. It's a multilingual world in which we communicate more and more in signs and symbols. What happened to the power of the word? Can the text be read? Of course, when it's important. Need it be legible? Not at all. This doesn't make it any less wonderful. We've got to have rules, grammar, spelling, wordcraft, typographic nuance, just not all the time. They are stultifying and lovely, stifling and truly elegant. The word is a layer I am not willing to relinquish. It drives my work, informs the visual experience, and has a place on every page I print. Diana, show us the man with the crazy hair. Here he is. Have you ever experienced an identity meltdown? Okay. And finally, I pay tribute to my teachers, mentors, and colleagues. Every move is in dialogue with those whose vision has captured or reflected my own. Miriam Rice, artist and mother. Ray Rice, artist and teacher. Jack Stoffaker, typographer and teacher. Sherwood Grover, a gentleman and a fine printer. Leland Vandiver, Lee, mentor and linotype operator. Gary Young, poet, printer, and friend. Five Trees Press, women printers and colleagues in a male-dominated field. Colleagues and collaborators, authors, artists, and students. When Guillermo and Gustavo ask me to consider making a book in response to their video, an homage to mentors and colleagues from the vantage point of age, I understand their impulse. As the youngest of three, I've been watching and listening and learning hard from those I love and respect all my life. Acknowledging these figures has been as critical as breathing. Doc Undoc is the sequel to the Codex Espangliensis, which I published in 1998. The Codex was a collaboration between Guillermo Gomez Peña, writer-activist, Enrique Chagoya, artist-printmaker, and myself, bookmaker-printer. 9 years later, while discussing who would be the visual artist for Doc Undoc, with our collaborator, Gustavo Vazquez, Guillermo turns to me and asks, "Do you draw?" At three, I ran to my mother because my big sister had made me cry, and my mother said, "Draw it. Draw what happened." When your mother is a children's art teacher and she sees art as the way to process any and all experience, you draw and you write, and there's resistance when you don't. I respond, "Yes, I draw," even though I had rarely incorporated my drawings into my book work. Guillermo says, "You draw," in the imperative. It was imperative that I did. Collaboration is an active acknowledgement of the other, a call and response. What results from the mix has unique merit. In this 7-year collaboration, I experienced a profound metamorphosis. I slowly emerged from behind my elegant typography and careful craft, explored and privileged my mark-making, and pulled it into my prints. As we added collaborators to the group, Jennifer Gonzalez, art historian and critic, Zachary Watkins, sound artist, over dinners and meetings and through correspondence, another element developed, the aluminum traveling case for apprentice shamans. Only five hearts and minds could have conceived of this invitation to a self-reflective and transformative experience for all those reinventing themselves and crossing borders. Thus, the subtitle, Ars Shamanica Performatica. Open the case. Open your mind. Explore freely, touch everything. Empty the silk bags, empty your heart. Choose an object, find a poetic way of using it. Reimagine yourself, tell a new story. The transformation is now complete. Then collaborate with four other artists. Embrace difference. Thank you. Are there any questions? I'm open for questions.
Who's the imagery of the two founders of the Mexican independence?
Those are mine. Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I was wondering, like I saw one, mm-hmm. and then I asked Maria, oh yeah, I said, was he dressed in drag?
Probably, yes.
And then the other one, he was kind of like a little animal, or?
Yes, with a knight, sort of a knight's armor on, and yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you get any reaction from, say, a Mexican audience about
not yet,
that
not yet. That book, the book is showing in Mexico in November.
Oh, okay.
As part of a big artist book show in conjunction with the International Book Fair in Guadalajara.
Okay.
At the end of November. It was a honored to be selected. There were 256 applicants from mostly Latin America and Mexico, and I was selected as one of 60 finalists, only four Americans represented.
Okay, because so. I've just, you know, the hallowed figures of Mexican independence and drag.
Yeah, perfect.
But it's coming from also a country that has some of, I mean, the Cristero revolts and stuff like that, and the aversions to the church, but it's nominally a Catholic nation.
Yes, yeah, it's really interesting.
Saying something against a church or a priest or something like is no big deal, you know.
Yeah. All that is part of the zeitgeist of the work and of this work that I've been part of with Gustavo and Guillermo and Jennifer and Zachary. We've all been absorbing what is going on currently, what's going on historically, can we bring the history into the present, how can we change and kludge together new images from what we know and what we don't know yet, where we're going, with ultimately the message being embrace difference. Any other questions?
Well, I mean, just sort of comment thinking about what you're saying, Jesse, and I thought of the text in one of the earlier pages that, like, my goal is to make you uncomfortable.
Yes.
You know, the goal of art is to sort of make you squirm and, like, be, like, feel confronted or even maybe even sometimes aggressed in some way, violated, offended.
Transgression.
All of these things, yeah.
That quote is my job is to keep not to heal the wound, but to keep the wound open.
Right. So, what is the value of keeping the wound open? Like,
what's the point
of pain and discomfort?
I think that's a question, and it's also a really great that whole thing about a love-hate relationship, these conflicting feelings, this conflicted experience, it hurts right now as it's biting my neck, but it's hilarious. You know, this is kind of how we live. This is how we live through each day. This is how we live with one another. There's this like horror at the same time. There's some way that we survive through humor, through not glossing over what's there, what we know is there, not making nice.
Too, I'm also thinking of like the constructed like sort of nature of things, because the book is all about sort of fabrication and artifice and intentional like sort of disarrangement and putting things back together. And so biting my neck and I'm laughing, it's like, you know, laughing only means what it means. Its association to humor is only because we've constructed it that way. And so, I mean, laughing could be a response to pain. An alternate universe or something. I don't know, you know. So just like messing everything up to even maybe find new meaning.
Yeah. I don't know if it came through, but making this was very painful.
Oh, yeah.
It was really, really hard. It was physically difficult. It was incredibly demanding. The rest of my life went away. I have a full-time job, and I had a second full-time job making this work. Nothing else went on for years. So I felt I gave like this huge portion of myself to realizing just an image that I had in my head that was grown there by conversation and a certain amount of encouragement by mentors and also my collaborators. And I would not stop until it was done. And it was done on September 1. That was when the book published 3 weeks ago. So I feel great. You know, I feel very relieved.
I just wondered if you could comment on who you would imagine to be the primary audience for this work or work like this. And I'm asking that because the title is very provocative. Mm-hmm. I mean, very thought-provoking. Mm-hmm. But my hunch is that the undocumented are not going to ever see this work. I mean, they might, but it's not. They're often not going to be in a place where this work is going to be a natural thing that they're going to
might not
come
be
across.
Part of their experience.
Right.
Might be.
Might be.
There are numerous.
So
constituency
did you have an audience,
for this
audience. Did you
audience.
Have an audience in mind? I mean, I can envision there would be lots of audiences who might see it, but when you were creating it, did you think of a particular audience for it?
I wasn't. There's lots of answers to that question. I was doing it for me. I wasn't doing it for the audience. I was very clearly had two audiences in mind, one for the original limited edition, which would be an audience like this who would find it in an institution and therefore have access to the original, the case, be able to observe it and work with it, perhaps an individual collector, that's very rare. And then, just as with the Codex Hispangliensis, you saw that I was selling something for $25 tonight, that was a trade, what we call a trade edition of the original limited edition that extended to 31 feet and was hand-printed. I would like to see this original book also available for, well, tonight I'm selling what might be very much the content of the trade edition for $20, the actual text so that you can read them. That's useful. And I also provide that pamphlet with the book so that it could be displayed when a spread is out and trying to read. It makes people uncomfortable when they can't read it. They don't like that, you know. And so there's the text. You can read that text. It's critical to what's going on. I don't want it to disappear. And so a trade edition that would show the text, the prints, the essay by Jennifer Gonzalez, which you really ought to read. It's really fabulous. Little essay of my own, an essay by Guillermo Gomez Pena. And then that book would be available at a reasonable price to a broad audience. So that Codex Hispangliensis has been in print since 2000. It's been selling since 2000. It continues to sell. This last month, I got two requests for permission to reproduce images from the book from academics who were publishing books that had portions writing about the book. And then at the same time, I received, two of them. There was something else. Oh, a woman sent me her MA thesis that she had written on it. People are teaching it in so that's a model. Wow, whoever knew that that book was going to blow up like that and be seen by so many people over so many years. And it was also my signature work. So for me, it was a challenge to do another piece because I've done other work since then, but none of it blown up, you know. It was a challenge when I was asked to do this book. It was not just, would you make a book in response to our video? I'll think about it. I thought, oh my God, I made a book with this man before and look where it went. Can I do anything less than that? And then when he said, you draw, and it's not Enrique Chigoya who has his reputation carrying the book along, it's me, it was an incredible challenge. And that's part of why I worked so hard to try to make something, at least within my own mind, that would take me to the next level with my own work. And perhaps this book has the same kind of life as the Codex Hispangliensis. As far as people who may not come to this kind of book or find it in a bookstore or in a college course or whatever, that's something that I can't know. I can't know that family won't include someone who loves the arts and seeks out something just like this.
I really, really enjoyed the presentation. Yeah. I have a two-part question. Mm-hmm. One is, can you explain the significance or comment on the significance between the altar and the significance that has in the Latino community and how that connects with the performance tonight? And also, I was curious, kind of piggybacking this question, is there any partnership where the team will provide proceeds to a partnering organization dedicated to undocumented persons, or what is the next steps, I guess, mm-hmm, with the success?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the first part, the altar, what's the significance of the altar? in relation to the book, it's the project as a whole, and then the performance. The altar has a place in Chicano iconography, in Chicano art, and the altares or the ofrendas are part and parcel of the work that's been going on since the 60s in this movement, the Chicano art movement. So in that sense, it's got a home. In another sense, when you open this case and you see the Cabinet of Curiosities, which has its own history and its own, and why is it there? You could go, historically, there's a reason why it's there. The altar is reflecting, it's full of mirrors. It's reflecting you back to yourself. It's distorting you in concave mirrors and it's convex mirrors, and it's your opportunity also to put on that object and look at yourself in a new way. So that's sort of the significance of this altar and why this altar has a home, because it's part of this transformational experience that we're inviting you to join in. We all had it. You know, you find four artists, you make a book, you show it, you know, you do it too. You can do it too. Tell a new story. Do you have to? You don't have to, but you might want to, you know. And then in terms of the performance, the altar and the performance, well, the performance just comes in here as my sharing with you my experience over 7 years. You know, I don't know if it's going to change through time and had new elements or whatever, but it's been an incredible part of the challenge that I was given by my collaborators. So that whole thing of collaboration being a call and response, and when Guillermo says to me, you draw, what a fabulous collaborator. Someone who comes into my life and says, take the next step. Maybe for him it wasn't such a moment, but for me it was a huge moment. And I'll be forever grateful to him for doing that for me. It was a gift. Bring people into my life that'll do that for me, that's pretty great. Yeah. And your second question was, about money for...
Like
sharing.
Or partnering with any organizations that serve undocumented persons?
I'd like to see that trade edition have a portion of the sales go to the appropriate organization, and that's the critical thing. Will it be one organization over 15 years, or how will we distribute the funds? But I'm working very hard. I've been working hard for years because our first book was a collaboration between Moving Parts Press, my press, and City Lights Books in San Francisco. I've been working very hard with the editor there, who's now the director, who I've got this other book. You might really want to publish it. You know, we really want to do this. No, if you don't want to do it, I'm going to do it. This is a real winner. We've got to do this book. So I'm still, you know, like, got no final word. I know she isn't closed, but there's part of her role as director and where she publisher, where she has to really think about where does this fit in the niche that we occupy, and does an art book, will she just take it as an art book and say an art book doesn't fit? We do poetry, we do political commentary, we don't do art books, and then, well, maybe I'll do it. I just won't have the reach that a larger press has.
Okay, anybody else?
Were you going to say something? Did you already?
Yeah. Could you just tell us a little bit about Moving Parts Press?
Sure, yeah.
What is it? Is it a collective of artists, book artists, or a collection, or people who come in and out, or, yeah, just something about it?
There's a recorded, it's on the website for this book, is docundoc.com, and I'm really proud of it, so go there. It's the same kind of invitation to an interactive experience. You have to explore it and spend time with it, and it includes two short videos, and in one of the videos, Gomez Peña is saying, Moving Parts Press, the artist book collective. And I was like, collective, the artist book collective. That's great. It's actually me. It's been me for a long time, since 1977. I started publishing feminist poetry. My first book of poetry sold 500 copies in 3 months. I thought, oh, wow, I'm going to make a lot of money. this is really going to work. I'm going to make published books of poetry. Well, that was an anomaly. You know, the next book, I didn't have anywhere near that success. But also, I started jumping around. I started working with different artists who had different audiences. I was interested in local poets, actually poets who were working locally, and then regionally, and then statewide, and then nationally, and then internationally, just exploring different groups, using my handset type or my machine set type and my letterpress technology. And then it wasn't until the early 90s, and really early 90s, I started exploring making very fine books, because I had that history. I'd worked with some really fine bookmakers in California, Adrian Wilson, Jack Stauffacher, Sherwood Grover. I mean, there are the greats on the West Coast in the book world, and I had worked with like five of them, you know. And so although I had rejected making fine books that were very expensive and nobody could see them or afford them, and that was wrong, you know, my first book that sold 500 copies was $4, you know. And that was during the small press movement, and a lot of smaller presses were making, and letter presses were making literary publications like that. But eventually, I went through a long period of discouragement where I thought, there are other people doing this, and they do it a lot better than I do. Copper Canyon Press, and you know, we're doing these beautiful books, and I thought, I'm just not, I mean, I can try, but they're doing it already. Why should I? It took me until I was quite a bit older to finally go in the early 90s, if I don't make my books, nobody else will make my books. Nobody's going to make my books. I have to make my books or they won't exist. So that's when I started making limited edition artist books, fine books, because even though they were that terrible market and too expensive and all those political issues were hard against them, I was still always trying to make that trade edition that would justify their existence in the world. Internally, inside, there was this push to make the books that I could imagine that no one else could do, was no one else was going to make. And that wasn't okay with me. So it was slow. I think in a sense, I was almost like a late bloomer, you know, to believing in myself. And so all that hiding behind craft, I mean, all that hiding behind typography, because I'm a very good, fine, elegant typographer, but it was many years of just not revealing myself. So this is sort of just like taking off the apron, you know, here I am.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess before we wrap it up tonight, I just wanted to call your attention to two more of Felicia Rice's works that are in the Chavez collection. One is a beautiful book, Alfabeto Animado, which is a textile, a woven sheet book of alphabet with handmade finger puppets. It's a trilingual book, English, Spanish, and
Quechua.
And I was telling Felicia that I was having a hard time understanding why the pictures didn't match the letters. And I think I'm too used to thinking in English because the pictures were in Spanish. I mean, the images were supposed to be representative of Spanish words. But it's a beautiful piece, and that is one of ten?
Eight.
One of eight, and we have eight of eight. So we were very happy to have gotten that book. I believe Mary Jo Zeter is the person who purchased that one. Mary Jo Zeter is the Latin American Studies bibliographer. We also have Amor Oscuro, mm-hmm. Francisco X. Alarcón, which is also in special collections. What you will find down there besides Codex Espanglesis and the actual book that goes in this book cover are two other artists, a Chicana from Chicago, a young Chicana book artist. Her name is Jenna Rodriguez, and then a New Mexican artist by the name of Freya Diamond, who has been around New Mexico and has picked up the nuances of the culture and of our history and stuff, and it's done in a flag fashion. So those are really good books to just kind of go down and explore. It's a growing collection in special collections with the support of Dr. Berg. I think that I know that Battle Creek, Linda Tafoya from Battle Creek, is interested in collaborative work between her museum and the MSU libraries. Hopefully it's something that we can move on. For tonight, I want to thank Professor Contreras for co-sponsoring, Patrick Olson for your words. Thank you very much. And Felicia Rice, thank you very much for
thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you. Coming here has just been such a great experience for me, trailing Deanna around the library all day and meeting everyone, every corner, and turning and meeting fresh faces. I just really want to acknowledge how I realize how hard you've worked to build the collection that is here and how significant it is that you have spent almost 20 years building this important collection of work here in Michigan. Appreciate you being a part of it.
It's the best in the Midwest, yes. And it's been fun and it's been great. Our development officer has been kind enough to feed us and
tonight,
give us
a yes.
drink tonight. So please help yourselves to the rest of the fruit and nuts and cookies. And thank you very much, Seth.
Thank you.